Future of Journalism, Episode 14. Two journalists were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in October for what the committee called their courageous work, standing up for the craft in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press increasingly face adverse conditions. Now, you might say, so what? Why give the award to Maria Ressa in the Philippines and Dmitry Muratov in Russia? That it would be better going to, for instance, the people who discovered the vaccines for COVID, or one of the champions of climate change. I'm Peter Wilkinson with the Alliance for Journalist Freedom, and here Julie Pizzetti argues the case for journalism. Based in Oxford, she's the Global Director of Research at the Washington-based International Center for Journalists. So, Julie, what is the significance, do you think, of those two Nobel Peace Prizes?
I think they're very significant awards, and that's because the Nobel Committee appears to be signalling that journalism is in peril, and in peril globally in a way that it hasn't been affected and afflicted since World War II. I mean, the last time the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded for acts of journalism, if you like, it was 1936, and the recipient was a German editor who was languishing in a concentration camp, having been placed there by the Nazis. So, you know, I don't think you could get stronger symbolism to demonstrate the perspective that journalists are under attack physically, digitally, politically, legally, being harassed en masse, both online and offline. And I think it's particularly significant that one of the recipients actually was a woman, because we see women journalists really sitting at the epicenter of a conflagration of risks at this point in the 21st century.
What do you mean by that?
In Maria's case, she's assaulted on an hourly basis with threats of rape, death, you know, violent assault, where she is falsely conflated with fake news, where she is harassed in such a way that we concluded in our research that she actually is being the victim of an enabling environment, partly created and facilitated by the platforms, and then fueled and exploited by the Duterte regime. And in that experience is a lot of sexualized threats and abuse. And so I think we now see women on the front line of these fights in ways that we didn't a century ago.
Yeah, and tell me a bit about Dmitry Muratov in Russia.
Yeah, so there you have, an editor who has held the line for several decades, having founded or co-founded Russia's, really last remaining significant independent journalism outfit, partly funded by Gorbachev, after he won the Nobel Prize. In fact, some of his prize money was contributed to that, having established this news outlet with really significant global recognition attached to it, to the credibility of their reporting. I mean, they lost six journalists. Six journalists have been murdered since the outlet was started. That is, I think, a significant testament to perseverance and courage, of course, the work that's done there. But in the Russian context, you have an increasing number of journalists and editors and outlets being branded as foreign agents because of the work that they're doing, which is another of the trends we're seeing internationally, the criminalization of journalism.
And do you think that the Nobel Peace Prizes really make a difference to will make a difference to the future of journalism?
I actually think it's more momentous than I expected it to be. I co-lead a coalition of international organisations called the Hold the Line Coalition, which was formed to support and defend Maria Ressa and Rappler and journalists in the Philippines more broadly after her conviction on a trumped-up charge of cyber libel. We're seeing evidence of that diplomatically. We're seeing evidence of that certainly in terms of the way The global news media has been fired up, you know, to even more loudly defend press freedom, and with a sense of pride in, you know, critical independent journalism, which is what we're fighting to preserve.
You head up research at the International Centre for Journalism. Tell me about that organisation and its role in protecting journalists, and how you see, or how it sees, the future of journalism.
So ICFJ has been around for nearly 40 years. It was established by former editors in the US. It works globally, and it works in the context of media development internationally, but it does so in a way that's very contemporary. It seeks to seed and support both startup efforts and journalism that might appear to be more traditional on the surface, insofar as it might be investigative, it might be journalism that's designed to respond to a particular crisis in a particular context, particularly in fragile democracies, for example. And it's about trying to ensure that journalists have both the capacity and the skills and the support to innovate in ways that actually help preserve the fundamental principles of journalism, rather than just toying with technology for the heck of it, which I think has been you know, a misstep in many efforts over the past couple of decades. So it's an organisation that deeply invests in enterprising journalism. It's also an organisation that recognises and rewards international journalists such as Maria Ressa, a host of others, particularly in Eastern Europe, for example, in parts of Africa, in other parts of Asia, where doing journalism is potentially life-threatening, and certainly often involves the threat of incarceration. So it's a combination of media development and media freedom work that I think tells us something about the future, and that is it has to be continuously a matter of reinventing the ways we can connect to audiences and ensure that we have a viable profession in terms of its sustainability financially, but also that it continues to produce journalism that serves open societies.
And in the Western countries, the economic pressures are really important. Mm-hmm. How do you see the future, or how do you see moving beyond the worst aspects of tabloid journalism, clickbait, etc., to something a bit more promising?
So I think we have to avoid what we've termed shiny things syndrome, where we're technology-led, and particularly in the past decade, platform-led. I think we have to be increasingly critical of the power that the platforms wield and the ways in which they have attempted to set the agenda for journalism, even through soft power type plays. I think that they have a role potentially in funding critical independent journalism, but that needs to be at a much greater distance from the practice of journalism than it currently is. I think that genuinely is one of our biggest challenges, and it's one that we've kind of sleepwalked into in a state of desperation for funding. It's very tempting and completely understandable to take the money that's thrown at you. But in the same way that we wouldn't be putting out our hands for big tobacco money, we shouldn't be, to fund health journalism, I think we need to be extremely cautious about the relationship we have with the platforms and take a more critical approach. But I think on the other side, to be able to continue to demonstrate in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a climate crisis, where the world literally, you know, is in the midst of combined existential crises, and we have such a flood of misinformation and disinformation that is being, you know, poorly stemmed by the platforms and fed by ignorance, then we have a really important role to play in journalism to ensure that we bring our audiences closer to the facts, and that we respect those audiences in doing so, that we avoid the sort of arrogance, or reasserting the sort of arrogance, that led to a decline in trust in the first instance over the past couple of decades within journalism, and that we focus firmly on being rather, you know, technology enabled to an extent, not technology led.
Yes, I wonder if the change that you're talking about to do with misinformation is going to happen with journalists and publishers, or whether simply the audience will get used to sorting fact from fiction and will sort of grow out of this current period. Because one of the things that I've noticed in the this century is that people do now accept that change is occurring rapidly. And so it's the public that can change more than the journalists, if you know what I mean, or the Facebooks and Googles who are responsible for the misinformation.
I think that's, you know, that's a media literacy argument. It's a reasonable argument, but it's not a short-term solution. It's a long-term solution. Mm. And I frankly don't think we have time to rely on the development of new attitudes and skills that have really only been properly inculcated, you know, over the past 5 years within a classroom context. I mean, there are generations who are not going to take up, you know, the sort of verification skills we would like to see applied to social media that, say, my 12-year-old daughter can now practice, courtesy of education and a hyper alert mother. I think we need to be very careful of suggesting that the solution lies in media literacy development, that is the skills of the audience to simply discern more effectively what's fact and what's fiction. And not only because this is a long-term project compared to figuring out design solutions at the core of Facebook or Instagram's, you know, business model, which is what promotes and spreads at such speed and at such volume the kinds of disinformation narratives that are so problematic. But we also need to be mindful that this is an argument that's being put by those who would rather shift the responsibility onto the user. So make women responsible for dealing with the sorts of abuse they deal with online, make children more responsible for the sort of content they are exposed to. So while we can argue that media literacy and self-defense mechanisms are important, and they certainly are, and we need to do a lot to support the development of those, we absolutely have to get to the core of the problem, which is the design and business models associated with the platforms, when it comes to viral disinformation at least.
Yeah, so I take it, I'm going to assume that you're an optimist for the future because you're working in the field, but what do you see journalism looking like in 15 to 20 years?
I think that would have been an easier question to answer 5 to 10 years ago, just, you know, even though we were in the midst of this massive transformation. It's an ongoing transformation. And it's difficult, you know, during the pandemic and at ICFJ, I run two projects that are relevant to this. One is the Online Violence Project in partnership with UNESCO, and another is the Journalism and the Pandemic Project in partnership with Columbia University's Tau Center for Digital Journalism. And in the context of both of those big projects, which are global and involve a lot of partners, researchers and institutions, I have both been more pessimistic on the one hand and more optimistic on the other. Pessimistic because of the scale of the problems that we're looking at. And as you know, if you factor in media viability, which I think we need to understand as not just an economic question, but one of journalism safety and press freedom as well. I'm more optimistic on the other hand, because this period and what we've learned has presented both, you know, catastrophic losses, but also real gains in terms of insight and in terms of critical engagement with questions of the future of journalism. So for years as a journalist and academic, I was a bit flummoxed by the lack of critical engagement with these questions, you know, in newsrooms. It was almost like this was happening out there, this, you know, these debates and these crises. Now I have a real sense that, you know, at every desk, at every laptop, on every phone where a journalist is working, there is a real understanding of what we're fighting for and why. And I think that commitment to credible, reliable, independent journalism has actually increased in the context of these crises for those who can remain to fight. And at the same time, it's given us a chance to understand our audiences better and to realise the purpose of that, you know, close engagement with communities, which is where journalism began. So with that in mind, I think the future has to look like the survival of independent journalism that takes a critical attitude to power. So that does mean investigative reporting, but not only investigative reporting. It doesn't mean we take, you know, the fun out of storytelling when it comes to, you know, human endeavor and the, you know, stories of relationship triumph and whatever the case may be. But we need to do so in a way that really responds to the threats that our communities are facing and the joys that our communities are experiencing. So I hope it's a public service that is viable and that does not forget that even in a Western liberal democracy like Australia, journalism is constantly under threat from those in power who would rather see the truth hidden.
Terrific. Julie Pezzetti, thank you so much.